Tonight I want to talk about a Buddhist text called the Vimalakirti Sutra. Are any of you familiar with this? A few. I'm going to read you a passage. It's from the beginning of chapter 2. And then I'll tell you a little bit about it. At that time, there lived in the great city of Vaisali a certain Lichavi, Vimalakirti by name. Having served the ancient Buddhas, he had generated the roots of virtue by honoring them and making offerings to them. He had attained tolerance as well as eloquence. He played with the great super knowledges. He had attained the power of incantations and the fearlessnesses. He had conquered all demons and opponents. He had penetrated the profound way of the Dharma. He was liberated through the transcendence of wisdom. Having integrated his realization with skill and liberative technique, he was expert in knowing the thoughts and actions of living beings. He lived with the deportment of a Buddha, and his superior intelligence was as wide as the ocean. He wore the white clothes of the layman, yet lived impeccably like a religious devotee. He lived at home, but remained aloof from the realm of desire, the realm of pure matter, and the immaterial realm. He had a son, a wife, and female attendants. He appeared to be surrounded by servants, yet lived in solitude. He seemed to eat and drink, yet always took nourishment from the taste of meditation. He made his appearance at the fields of sports and in the casinos, but his aim was always to mature those people who were attached to games and gambling. He visited the fashionable heterodox teachers, yet always kept unswerving loyalty to the Buddha. He understood the mundane and transcendental sciences and esoteric practices, yet always took pleasure in the delights of the Dharma. He mixed in all crowds, yet was respected as foremost of all. In order to be in harmony with people, he associated with elders, with those of middle age, and with the young. He engaged in all sorts of businesses, yet had no interest in profit or possessions. To train living beings, he would appear at crossroads and on street corners, and to protect them, he participated in government. To develop children, he visited all the schools. To demonstrate the evils of desire, he even entered the brothels. To establish drunkards in correct mindfulness, he entered the cabarets. He was honored as the businessman among businessmen because he demonstrated the priority of the Dharma. Thus lived the Lichavi Vimalakirti in the great city of Vaisali, endowed with an infinite knowledge of skill in liberative techniques. Have any of you heard anything like this before from Buddhism? A little surprising, maybe. This is a very unusual sutra, but it is a sutra. It's from the same wisdom tradition as the Heart Sutra. It's from the Prajnaparamita tradition. And it seems to have been... It was originally written in Sanskrit, like the other sutras, but the original has been lost. It's preserved in Tibetan and in Chinese. This translation is by Robert Thurman from the Tibetan. The Tibetans were very literal about translation, one Sanskrit word for one Tibetan word. So if the Tibetans have it in their canon, it means that it was an old sutra in the Indian tradition. Now, there's a great many things about this sutra that are unusual. It's one of the only sutras that has a kind of drama to it. It's almost like theater. And I talked to Gil about it last week, and of course he has a more scholarly background than I do, and his theory, there are many theories, is that this was written as a kind of satire, actually, partly, to make fun of the monks a little bit. And in the sutra, in fact, Vimalakirti is extolled as having wisdom superior to all the great disciples of the Buddha who are reluctant to go visit him because they're afraid of his wisdom. He'll show them up. And so there are many comical things that happen, one of which you probably know that in the Buddhist tradition, in the ancient times, the status of women was, according to the culture of that time, very much second class. And there's a scene in this sutra where a goddess comes down from the skies and visits Shariputra, who's the great disciple of the Buddha, a monk, And Shariputra informs her that she can't be enlightened until she gets reborn as a man, because that was the doctrine at that time. So the goddess, through her magical powers, has them switch bodies. And Shariputra suddenly ends up with her body. She's very beautiful. And she ends up with Shariputra's body. And then she says, well, what do you think now, Shariputra? Would you like to repeat the doctrine which you just extolled? And he's all confused, doesn't know what to do. So I think part of Gil's feeling is that throughout Buddhist history, there's always been a kind of dynamic tension between the monastics and the lay supporters. And this sutra is partly about that. It's also about many other things. Why I'm very interested in it, and I'm really making it the theme of my sitting group that I'm starting up again. He's kind of the patron saint of it, is because I think this is pretty descriptive of our actual situation, or at least what we're aspiring to. We'd like to be like Vimalakirti, and yet I think we have a very strong feeling that we'd also like to be like Shariputra or like the monks. So that's one thing I'd like to talk about tonight. The other is, there's a great mystery behind this picture of Vimalakirti, the householder who is able to go into any situation, probably more than even you would. I don't know how many of you go to Las Vegas to enlighten gamblers, but he did. Or go to brothels and enlighten the prostitutes, but he did. And presumably their customers, but he did. How did he get that way? What kind of practice got him to this point? Was he at one time a monk and then graduated and got better than that? Or was he never a monk and he had some special practice that allowed him to leap over what the monks did? Was it all done in former lives somehow when he was a rabbit or a tiger? You know, sometimes the Buddhists talk that way. I think this is a very interesting question. What was the actual practice that brought Vimalakirti to this exalted place? And was it exalted? Is this a description of some kind of highest state? He's described as being the wisest of the wise except for the Buddha. The Buddha is the only one who is higher than Vimalakirti, as it's described in the sutra. And so what's better about the Buddha? Well, how does the Buddha, who of course did not live like this at all, we know that. In fact, he left this kind of life behind. That's his legend. He used to be like that. He used to be a prince, and presumably he had concubines and gambled and all those sorts of things that rich people do. And he left that behind to become the greatest of ascetics. So what is this all about? What are we entering into here? I have to tell you that throughout the ages, this sutra has been controversial and troubling to the Buddhist establishment. Not surprisingly, since the Buddhist establishment has been carried throughout the generations by monks and nuns who are roundly criticized throughout this sutra. So you can imagine they wouldn't want to lift this sutra up as the ultimate teaching. And yet there's something very compelling about the notion of someone like this. And throughout it all, he translates it, the term upaya, as liberative techniques. But there is this term upaya in Buddhism, which means skill in means or flexibility in technique or means to bring people to the Dharma. And it's a very highly treasured skill in the Mahayana, in the great vehicle teaching. But throughout Buddhism, the Buddha himself, if you read the sutras carefully, was always adjusting his teaching to the capacities of his listeners. for example, the core teaching, really, of the Buddha is anatta, or no abiding self. But there are times in the sutras where he extols the self. And someone comes to him, and some nihilist school person, and talks, and the Buddha says, well, actually, there is a self. And afterwards, one of his disciples says, why did you say that to that person? That's not your teaching. You usually say there's no abiding self. And the Buddha explains, well, to that person who needs to come away from his nihilist views, I teach the self to bring him away from his misunderstanding. So upaya is always there, back to the earliest days of Buddhism. So the basic quality of Vimalakirti is that he's so secure in his understanding of the Dharma that he is incapable of being disturbed wherever he goes. And in fact, not only that, he intentionally goes into disturbing situations because he can manage it. And by being able to manage it, he can change the situation, bring people closer to the Dharma. This is a very, to me anyway, a very wonderful thing, and something that I think we all ought to aspire to. There is a very strong quality in the Dharma that we understand that it's very much about our own path and about our own liberation and about breaking through to the understanding of Dharma. But there's also an equally strong quality that the only useful thing, really, to do with that breaking through is to share it. Otherwise, you're what's called a pracheka Buddha. You just hide away in a cave, and it's just for you. So the only place to go with that is to go wider and wider until you become like Vimalakirti, and everywhere you go, you're spreading the Dharma. So we keep coming back, I do anyway, to this fundamental question: what was Vimalakirti's actual practice? How did he become like this? There's no description in the entire sutra about that at all. They just talk about how he is and these various dramatic teachings that put forward various metaphors about attachment and about non-duality and so forth. But it doesn't say anything about what his teaching was or what his practice was. So let me just pause and you know, I come from the Zen tradition primarily, and I know that you're practicing in the Vipassana or insight meditation tradition. Let me ask any of you, if somebody asked you, what is your practice, what would you say? What is your core practice? Let's say when you sit and when you meditate. Well, somebody must know. Yes.
I'll just say that I'm personally working on concentration, just concentration on the breath, because so many years of the mindfulness wasn't working very well, so I needed to go back and kind of remedial work, I guess you could.
Okay, well, let's not call it remedial work. Let's just say that you're working on concentration. Anybody else? Jim?
Yeah, I think for me it's paying attention and listening to whatever presents itself, both in meditation and out of meditation.
There's a koan, actually, Zen's teaching story, that goes, a student comes to the teacher and says, how do I enter the Tao? How do I enter the way? And the teacher says, do you hear the stream? And the student says, yes. And he says, that is how you enter it. So this is that. This is another way of talking about that. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to say my objective is to keep objective is to eliminate that. But it's, after doing it for years, I haven't been very successful. Anybody else in the
Well, you could try shooting a tranquilizer dart at the monkey. That's what the biologists do. That'll knock him out for a while. I'm sorry, I'm an inveterate jokester. Well, as I think many of you know, there are two main aspects to meditation practice. One is samatha, or concentration. So following the breath, for example, is the most fundamental and classical form of samatha. Although it's not just samatha, but let's say that it starts that way. To use what you're talking about, to slow down the monkey mind, to bring it to some calmness, to put some space in it. Not necessarily to stop it completely. That would be a little bit more pre-Buddhist yoga, maybe, or dhyana. That's incorporated in Buddhist practice. I wouldn't say so, no. Let's just say that it would be what it is, which is a state of mind where you're not thinking. It's a state of mind. To elaborate on that, let's just think of the Buddha, who we say is the great enlightened being. Clearly he had thoughts, because he talked about them all the time. His teaching were thoughts. In other words, he included in his understanding the conceptual mind was functioning. So, and it's very clear in his enlightenment story, actually, it's very precise. He goes down into a very deep state of samatha, or concentration, the lowest that you can go, in which there's hardly anything left. Then he rises back up. And in the first jhana, which includes listening, which includes a purified thinking, which includes ordinary consciousness, he opens his eyes at dawn and sees something. He sees the morning star. So it's very precise that the Buddha's enlightenment actually occurred in very close to what we might call ordinary consciousness. Although he was adept and very familiar with and understood the deep states of samatha. So this is the second main branch of Buddhism, which is vipassana. Vipassana and samatha are very closely related, but they're not quite the same. Vipassana, which means insight, is, well, let's just talk about the breath. Just to concentrate on the breath, to stop thinking, would be a samatha practice. But to concentrate on the breath with the background of what is the breath? Whose breath is it? Is this breath permanent or impermanent? If we start to inquire about the breath, then we enter the realm of vipassana. So the quality of inquiry, not just any inquiry, not just asking this question or that question, but a very deep kind of inquiry, is the vipassana side. So you can't say that it's remedial. I mean, I don't mean to criticize you for saying so. I understand you were sort of half-joking, but you can't say that samatha comes before vipassana. Samatha and vipassana are two halves. It's like the front hand and the side of your hand and the back hand. They go together. a mind of insight is intrinsically calm because it's freed from passions. But a calm mind is also capable of seeing into things. So the two things are both important. And this leads me back to my main point, which is, what is Vimalakirti's practice? How did he come to the point? Implied in this passage is that Vimalakirti, in a sense, lived in the monkey world completely. He had a wife and children, screaming babies running around, maybe several wives. This was ancient India, and he was a prince, so we don't know his exact household situation. He went to cabarets. He went to the horse track, perhaps. He went into all the situations that you and I might think are extremely distracting. And yet somehow his mind was unclouded. He was undisturbed. He was able to carry the quality of Dharma into those situations completely. And not just carry them in, but also work at transforming the beings who were there. So if Vimalakirti practiced samatha in these situations, it's clearly a kind of samatha that's pretty amazing, that we probably can't quite understand, that he's able to be completely concentrated at the racetrack, let's say. And if he practiced vipassana, it's also hard to understand how he was doing that. Because typically, we imagine that... Here's what I'm trying to get at. I think we as American Buddhists, and I think Buddhists in general, transformational Buddhists, people who are interested in transformation rather than just faith, imagine that the real practice, the serious practice, is some kind of retreat situation where you're completely quiet, nobody talks, there are no distractions, and you do that for several days, and you get into a deeper and deeper state of concentration, shall we say. And this is our model of really good concentrated practice, and everything else is something short of that. So we have a sensation that we'd like to be in retreat as much as we can, and that for us, being a householder is somebody who doesn't have the time to be in retreat all the time the way the monks do. And a monk has the notion, well, I'm very fortunate because I live a life in which I've given up all that, and I can devote myself uninterruptedly to Dharma without any distractions like the poor householders have to deal with. I don't have kids. I don't have a job. I don't have to deal with my boss. I can just, you know, meditate all day long. This is the conventional understanding, which I think pervades the Buddhist world, ancient and modern. Somehow this sutra runs interference through that conventional understanding, and it's unclear exactly why. And I think that traditionally, certainly the monks who have been the caretakers of the core meditation tradition, it's understandable they would rather suppress the sutra, which they pretty much did. It's not something that you find greatly praised or greatly referred to in the monastic tradition. But for all of us, we're in more or less Vimalakirti's situation. So, and it's kind of implying that this notion we have that the serious practice is retreat, and the in-between practice, waiting for retreats to happen, is our usual life, isn't quite how it's portrayed here. Here, it's a kind of seamless continuity. There's some kind of implied deep practice behind this, because Vimalakirti just didn't get born this way. But at the same time, one has a sense that his practice pervades every aspect of his life, and he's undisturbed wherever he goes, or she, because one of the other radical things about this sutra is that man, woman, there's no distinction. But we don't have a Vimalakirti school in Buddhism that would teach us how to practice like Vimalakirti in our daily life. The best we can do, and what I hear frequently, is people are a little regretful that they can't somehow bring their retreat or meditation experience more into their daily life. They'd like their daily life to be more like retreat, and it can't be, and they feel somehow bad about that. You know, does anybody have any feeling like that, or am I speaking about other people? I think this is pretty common at our stage of development in America. Let's go a little bit more deeply into Samatha Vipassana. Samatha relates to a set of experiences that go under the rubric in Buddhism of samadhi. Samadhi are states of concentration. And samadhi is very important. We need to have some experience. Samadhi is, for ordinary people, not part of their experience. Most people don't have much experience of samadhi. But you all who meditate do. It's partly physical. The breath slows and becomes regular. The heartbeat slows. The blood pressure drops. They can measure these things now. The scientists can wire you up and the brain waves change. This has all been well documented. Some of you may have seen the essay last Sunday, before last, by the Dalai Lama in the New York Times. Did any of you see this? He was basically saying, world, because the New York editorial page of the New York Times is like the top forum in English, the English language. World, please notice that scientists, not just we Buddhists, are able to measure the quality of calm, the quality of kindness that we have spent millennia developing in Buddhism. It's real, folks, in the West. It isn't just our fantasy. You can actually measure it, and he's working with scientists to do this, et cetera, et cetera. He's pleading with the world to please notice that the root causes of violence are in the mind. They're not in some political situation. I was a little sad, actually, to see that article because it's a great teaching and it's probably the premier forum in the West. And it's there on Sunday and then it's gone. And how many people really registered that? It's not easy to make an impact, even if you're the Dalai Lama. Anyway, samadhi is something that is fascinating at first and then extremely attractive. Because I think in samadhi, the experience we have of samadhi is maybe our first experience, as adults anyway, of being really completely calm and relaxed. Children, if you observe them closely, or if you think back and remember when you were a child, have the ability to slip into samadhi. You'd think that children are rushing around and so forth, but actually they have the ability to flow in and out of samadhi because they haven't been taught out of it, and their minds are very flexible. So children have a kind of natural samadhi. It's not a samadhi that has much understanding to it because their minds aren't yet mature, but they have that ability. So oftentimes I think people who come to their first couple of retreats feel a kind of sense of coming home. You have a sense, oh, I remember this, to feel the ease and the the quality of relaxation, and it's a kind of pleasure. There's an easeful pleasure to samadhi that is indescribable. And it's so powerful that those of us studying Buddhism here think that, well, this is it. The whole point of Buddhism is to get that more and more. If we can just get more samadhi, somehow eventually we'll get like Vimalakirti and we can carry it around with us like a wheelbarrow wherever we go, and we'll always be in that state. Oh, I have to end at 9, don't I? Ah. I thought it was 9:15. This is a little too much on the samatha side if we think this, because samadhi is still an experience. It's still on the side of something that you experience in time and space. But the Vipassana side is to probe deeper into that. And in the state of samadhi, you have a much greater ability to penetrate than in ordinary monkey mind, to penetrate, well, what's the actual situation that I'm in here? Who is this person having this experience at all? What is the actual quality of being here? Then that samadhi isn't an experience that you own. It's an experience that simply becomes the matrix, you might say, or the vehicle by which insight can occur. And the reality is, and this is the why it's okay not to feel regretful or down on yourself because you can't maintain your samadhi at your desk at work. The actual quality of Dharma practice is beyond what we can experience. It doesn't happen in the realm of something that you go into and come out of. We have that experience in retreat that we go into a very concentrated state and we come out of it. But the actual process isn't quite like that. It isn't like it goes from here to there. It's more like it goes from there to here, or that it doesn't go anywhere. You know, when you sit and meditate, you're returning to a fundamental place that's actually beyond what you can experience. So this description that I read to you is not exactly the description of some advanced being that we could not possibly emulate. This is a description of you. This is how it actually is. Wherever you go in time and space, the underlying quality of awakening is already there. You're already Vimalakirti. So why don't you feel like Vimalakirti? Well, that's the question, isn't it? But the fact that you don't feel like Vimalakirti is actually not the most important question. The most important question is, how does Vimalakirti actually practice the Dharma? So, now I'm speaking maybe more from the way Zen people talk, and maybe this is a little unfamiliar to you, but you know, we have to understand that these different schools of Buddhism really aren't that different, particularly in America. We're all practicing the Dharma. And each school has its emphasis, and each school has its special quality of speaking. So I'm bringing this sutra to you because, as I suspected, it's not part of your knowledge base here in the insight tradition. But it is part of the knowledge base of the American Buddhist scene. And I think it's an important sutra to know, because Vimalakirti's world is a lot like America, you know. I mean, even though it's ancient India, you look at the things that he's doing. I mean, he goes to bars. Well, there are a lot of bars in America, you know. And, you know, his world is our world. I was in a bar last fall. let me tell you why I was there. When I go to New York, I stay at my college club. You know, I get a cheap room there because I'm a member. And I was alone. So I went down. They have an ice bar there. And I went down to see what was going on. And I sat at the bar. I had a glass of wine. And there's other guys, you know, there who are alone on business or whatever. And they're lonely and they don't know what to do. And they're down at the bar drinking, too. So we strike up a conversation, and it's very interesting. And they're very interested in me. There was a doctor there, and I told him about my illness. I'd written a book about it, and we started to talk, and his life came out. And I thought about this sutra and I realized, well, gee, this is what Vimalakirti did. You know, not that I'm extolling myself and saying I wasn't really drinking. You know, I was just saving beans. I was getting rather drunk, actually. I mean, because you can't do much at a bar unless you drink. That's what it's there for. And everybody was drinking. I only had 3 glasses of wine, but I don't usually have that much. So that was enough. So that, and I observed, as I was talking and connecting with people, I observed, because I'm an old meditator and I'm used to it, I observed my state of mind. I watched myself become more intoxicated. I watched what I was saying, how I was acting. And I realized 2 things. One is that the people there were lonely. And not lonely in the sense that they didn't have company, but they were existentially lonely. They were all of them very successful. I mean, there's one guy, he's a venture capitalist, he's got a Jag, and he lives out here, and he's talking about his tennis club and this or that. I could sense underneath it all, he was, you know, there was something he was looking for. We didn't talk about Buddhism at all, we just talked. And then the doctor, you know, he's an ophthalmic surgeon. I could sense something there too. And I realized, you know, if I said to myself, well, I'm a Buddhist, I don't drink, I don't go to bars, I would have missed the opportunity for them to meet me and for me to meet them. And so I understood something about this sutra and felt a little more okay about being there and what happened. So I see my time is almost up, and I'm hoping I can leave a few minutes for some public questions and then we can talk afterwards. I'm not sure I got through exactly what I wanted to say, but I wanted to give you this quality of Vimalakirti because I actually think it can be a real source of encouragement to have this quality of understanding. Understanding that householder life need not be kind of monk light, if you know what I mean. You know, wish I could be a monk, but I can't, so I'll do what I can. This is a very conventional understanding, but this sutra has a different slant on those things. And it's not telling you about somebody that lived then, it's telling you about you, that all the sutras are always talking about you. So that's why I wanted to introduce you to it. So I hope it was of some use to you. If you have I guess we have time for a few questions. How strict are you about time? We have 2 minutes. Yes.
Would you consider Vimalakirti's practice to be an equanimity?
Yes, in fact, it explicitly says so, that he maintains equanimity, the perfection of equanimity at all times. In a later part of the sutra, it goes into that in some detail. But it's not your usual a sort of equanimity, because if you take this literally, he's hoisting one with the folks at the cabaret, and he's getting into things, and he's being with people at their level. So the kind of equanimity that it is something very profound. Let's put it that way. It's not like he's standing there like this, you know, and everybody around him is noisy, but he's calm. He's with them. You know, and yet somehow he's not moved. There's some quality where inside he's not moved.
I wonder, it seems to me, I mean, as you talk about it, it seems like it's asking to be treated as literature and art rather than as a manual. A lot of the sutras really are manuals in many ways. But this has the quality of art, that it inspires discussion, it remains somehow a mystery and somewhat opaque to us, but it provokes, and it evokes. So.
Well, Mahayana sutras are often like that. They're often celestial dramas of one kind or another. This is probably the most dramatic, you're right, of all the sutras. And there is a lot of art, almost kabuki theater about it. You know, the goddess coming down and, you know, changing bodies. And there's one part where Vimalakirti moves his big toe, and the whole world has changed. So, you know, it's very, it is like art. But, you know, Buddhism, when it's alive, Dharma is a lot like art. It is. It is art. It's the art of being alive. So there's a lot of the qualities we associate with art are also qualities in the Dharma when it's living. When it comes off the page and you actually with a person who spent a lifetime in Dharma, you feel a quality of, you're looking at a work of art. The work of art is the Buddha, you know. One more. I know I'm going over, but. Well, I'm actually posing the question, not implying an answer. I think that the question is what's interesting, because the question is a kind of Vipassana question. It's an insight question. I think it's a question also for American Buddhism. We're all householders; we live that way. So, how do we actually practice? That's something. My teacher, Suzuki Roshi, said, and it's in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, at the end, American students are neither monks nor lay people. That you are not monks is fairly easy to understand, but that you are not lay people is more difficult. Then he said, I think you're on your way to discovering some appropriate way of life. Now, I take that as my, you know, I'm his, in his lineage, and I was his student. So I take that as my charter. That was his wish in coming here, and that's my charter as best I can to continue that. But it's not an answer, it's a question. And the question itself is the practice. Because inquiry is more fundamental than meditation, actually. Inquiry comes first. Inquiry brings you here, you know. Inquiry is there long before you ever showed up here. There is an inquiry. So the inquiry is the thing, isn't it? So I would say that if you forced me to give an answer and twisted my arm, I would say that female acuity's practice was inquiry. You know, in each of these situations that he was in, just like me at the club, you know, I was in a mode of inquiry. What's this all about? Am I okay here? What can I do? You know, that kind of thing. Inquiry can happen anywhere. It can happen on your deathbed. It can happen in the middle of the Giants game. It can happen in the bedroom. Inquiry doesn't need a special place. We probably, I have the feeling that the witching hour is nigh, so let's call it a night. And if any of you wish to continue the discussion, I'm certainly willing to do that. Thank you.